Hello, everyone, and welcome to today's FudSmart Innovation Series webinar. My name is Ashley Robinson, and I'm the editor of FudSmart. Today, I'll be serving as your host for this webinar. The theme for today's webinar is using wireworm control on your farm. This webinar is brought to you by the Canadian Potato Council. The Canadian Potato Council received funding for today's webinar through the Canadian Horticultural Council as part of the Canadian Agricultural Partnership. Our presenters for this webinar are Christine Narana, who is a research scientist with AAFC Charlottetown, and Wim Van Herk, who is a research scientist with AAFC Agassiz. In today's webinar, you'll learn about the biology of wireworm/click beetles, chemical control of wireworms, including new products, cultural control approaches such as rotation crops, how researchers are monitoring populations and species across Canada, and how researchers are assessing populations for damage potential. During the presentation, you'll likely have some questions for our speakers. Please type these into the chat box at any time during the webinar, and we'll address them during the question and answer session after the presentations. This webinar is being recorded and will be made available at smudsmart.com following this live event. Our first presenter is Christine Narana. Christine is a research scientist with AAFC Charlottetown. She obtained her PhD in entomology from McGill University. Following her PhD, she conducted research on the Colorado potato beetle at Laval University in Quebec City, later moving to Alberta, where she continued her research at AAFC Lethbridge. In 2000, she moved to PEI, where she started her current position. Christine's research has focused on developing integrated pest management strategies with an emphasis on techniques to manage insect pests in agricultural crop fields. Her research provides cutting-edge knowledge and technology to the industry and the scientific community. She invented the NELT, which impact of her innovative research on industry and science has resulted in frequent requests for consultations and advice from grower and industry groups across Canada, the U.S. and Europe, and invitations to speak at grower and industry meetings and scientific conferences. In 2016, she received an Agrologist Recognition Award for outstanding contributions to agriculture from the PEI Institute of Agrologists. Take it away, please, Christine.
Some of the management techniques that we have been developing over the years. The wireworm research team, when we first started, was Dr. Bob Vernon started working on wireworms, and then myself and Todd Gabula joined him. And this was in the late 1990s. And we continued, and then Wim joined us, Wim Van Herk, who's going to be our next speaker. And later on, we had Ian Scott, who's in London, Ontario, joined the team as well. And our latest person who's joined the team is Dr. Haley Gaten, and she's at in Lethbridge, Ontario. Now, as mentioned before, I am in Charlottetown, and my team here, who's been working on wireworms for quite a while, is Dr. Andrew Bahar. Dr. Sutilu, she is actually a provincial entomologist, but has been working in my lab on wireworms, and mainly the adults, looking at the biology of the adults and a little bit on the wireworms as well. And then there's Natasha Mojigaland, who is the research technical assistant. So a little bit about wireworms. What are wireworms? They're the larvae of click beetles. They live in the soil for 3 to 5 years. And they can damage several crops. And these two aspects is what makes them a really incredibly difficult pest, not only to work with, but the pest that can cause a lot of damage in your fields. They cause a lot of damage to root crops. And to the extent that sometimes the feeding damage can actually result in the crop being completely unmarked. So this is some of the damage that you see in carrots. You can see these holes that they've made in potatoes. They make these holes that makes it look They feed on onions, cabbage, sorry, not cabbage, but rutabagas for root crops, as well as onions, rutabagas, any kind of root crops they will feed on and damage them. But they also feed on other crops, such as corn. They'll feed on corn seeds, barley seeds. They'll feed on carrot seeds as well. And they also feed on transplants, cabbage transplants, strawberry transplants. So they manage all these crops in the spring as well as in the fall. So something about the life cycle of this insect. So the pit beetles, they emerge in early spring, early summer. They live for about maybe 2 to 3 months, and during which time they mate and they lay their eggs in the soil. The larvae hatch and they start feeding on any root material that is present in the field. They'll feed all summer, and then in the fall they'll start feeding on any root crops that are present in the field. Now at the end of the fall, they will actually go deep down into the soil to overwinter, and they come back out in the spring. And once again, they come back to the surface and they start feeding on your crop again. And this cycle of going into the soil deeper down to overwinter and coming back up to the surface lasts for about 3 to 5 years. And after 3 to 5 years, they will mature, and the larvae will mature. They will pupate in the soil, and then they'll spend the winter in the soil, and they'll come back out as adult pit beetles in the spring. So they remain in this the worm stage is the damaging stage, and they remain in this stage for 5 years. So as you can see, once the field has wireworms in it, it's going to continue to have wireworms coming up and feeding on your crop for 3 to 5 years. And that 3 to 5 years depends on the species that I'm talking about. So our research, from the very beginning, we realized that one approach is not going to manage this insect. We had to use different strategies. So our research focused on an integrated approach. And so we looked at insecticides, and Dr. Wim Van Herp is going to talk to you about that. And then we looked at natural control, mechanical control, biological control. But we also looked at the biology of this insect. It's very important to know the biology, because unless you know what this insect is doing, it's hard to find techniques to control it. So we looked at the biology of wireworms. So today my presentation is going to focus on give information on the biology and what we found and how this has helped us in developing strategies that are important to manage this pest, and also some of the strategies and techniques and tools that we have developed over the years. So let's move on to the research on wireworm biology. What we found was that we monitored these beetles for a long time. This is the adults, so monitoring the adult beetles. We find that they are the peak of emergence is generally in June, in beginning of June to mid-June. That's when the females and the males emerge. Now I'm talking about Agriotis spicata. This may be a little bit different for other species depending on the temperature in other locations, but our main species on Prince Edward Island is Agriotis spicata. So that's what I've been working on all these years. So this timeline might be slightly different depending on the temperature in different locations, but this is what we found for Agriotis spicata. So moving forward with this, knowing when they emerge, So here I have a graph that showing when the emergence, early June is when most of the beetles emerge. And they start laying their eggs somewhere in early June. They will start laying eggs. So beetles emerge in May, they peak in June, but this time that they're emerging, they're actually mating in laying eggs. So those eggs you can see in early June. The egg peak is in late June to early July is when the numbers of eggs that you can find in the field is much higher. And the egg hatch generally the early eggs that you see in early June, they start to hatch at the end of June. And if the egg hatch peak, that is mid-July. The females, we found that they mate several times. In fact, their first mating, they can lay anywhere from 30 to 114 eggs.
Christine, second there. Could you speak up a bit more? I know we're getting a lot of questions about it. If you could just speak a bit more, louder a bit more.
Okay, I'll try. Okay.
Yeah, speak like that. Thank you.
Okay. I keep forgetting not being in a big room. I keep forgetting I'm speaking soft. So just keep reminding me if I'm speaking softly, okay?
Will do.
All right. Okay. So now looking at Agriotuscodata biology that I showed you before, looking at this in relation to your potato crop phenology, what we find is that it's actually pre-plant and planting is when you see the adults in the field. And the the peak egg hatch is at the growth stage 3, which is tuber initiation and tuber bulking, so between those two stages. And as you can see from here, there's a lot of food available for the hatching wireworms at that time. But there's lots of root material, there's the tubers that have just been formed, the conditions, the soil conditions are really good. So hatching and survival could be really high at that time. We looked at oviposition site, like where do they lay their eggs? And we found that they lay their eggs in the upper 2 centimeters of the soil. Now, although this is not going to, it tells us something, but it's important for us to know because if we ever have a biological control organism that feeds on eggs, we have to make sure that that organism is actually going and feeding on the eggs within that upper 2 centimeters, can actually move within those upper 2 centimeters. We don't have a biological control agent at this point, like a predator at least. We don't have that at this point. But, you know, this information is important to us because we could in the future have a predator that would feed on the eggs that we release in our field. So this is important information. Moving on to the movement. Now, unlike other organisms which are above ground organisms, we can see them. Insects above ground, we can see where they're moving, how they're moving, where they're going. But with wireworms, it's very difficult to see them because they're underground. And it's important to know where they are so that we can actually monitor them and find out if there is going to be a problem in our fields. So we need to monitor the populations. So in order to do that, we looked at the horizontal and vertical movement of these wireworms. In order to do that, we had these tubes where we placed the worms at one end and we placed the bait. In this case, I used carrot baits because that's what we normally use. So we placed the bait at 3.6 meters. And then we had another trial where we placed the bait at 1.8 meters and 3.6 meters. And then we did another one where we had 1.2 meters, 2.4 and 3.6. So today I'm going to just talk about these two trials that we did, but this is more or less the same as the other one. So I'm just going to talk about these two. when the carrot bait was placed at 3.6 meters from the wire worm release site, you can see that within one day, you have 20% of the large wire worms have moved 3.6 meters, and 15% of the small medium ones, and even the small ones have moved, 5% of them have moved within one day. Now, 3.6 meters may not seem that much for us, but for a little tiny wire worm, it's a very long distance to travel. So you can see that they can move quite fast in the soil. And by day three, you have 50% of them are at 3.6 meters and 20% of the medium ones are at 3.6 meters. And by day seven, you have even more of the medium ones that are at 3.6 meters. So they can move pretty fast. And this tells us that they are moving. 3.6 meters is not that difficult for them to move to. So then we looked at, okay, what happens if we have a bait at 1.8 and 3.6 meters? So what we found was that for one day, they got to 1.8 meters, not a problem. And they just sat there. No wire worms got to 3.6. On day three, there were 60% of the large wire worms were at 1.8 meters, but none of them were at 3.6. But then when we get to day seven, we see that there's a large number, 70% of the large wire worms are at the 1.8 meters. But then some of them even moved onto 3.6 meters. So this information told us that we usually leave our baits in for 7 days. But if we're leaving them for 7 days and the wire worms are coming to our bait and then they're moving on to another food source, but they don't stay there. There was plenty of food available, but they moved on. So this tells us that the baits that we are putting in for 7 days may not be such a good idea because we may get a false indication of what our population is. So we really need to put them in for 5 days. That's what would give us a good estimation of what our population is. We looked at vertical movement. So we wanted to know, when do they go down and when do they come back up over the winter? So we placed them in October and we started to see them going down in November. In December, they were at 32 centimeters. They were down December, January, February, March. April, they were starting to come up. And by May and June, they were up at the surface. So this information told us that if a bait is put in April for these wire worms, you may get a false indication that you don't have wire worms in your field. But really, wire worms are at the bottom. So it's better to put your baits in May. This is for us here in PEI because that's what we're doing. It depends on your species and how your species move and what the temperature is of the area, but this is what we found. So if we wouldn't put our baits out in April, we would put our baits out in May. And the same for earlier in the fall, if you put your baits out in November, you are going to see very few wire worms. You think your populations are really low, but really they aren't that low because most of them are at the bottom. So you get a false indication of what your population is. So this tells us that we should go in September and October to really look at our populations. Now, like I said before, this is for wire worms in our area. So we also put temperature probes in these tubes. And what we found was as the temperature goes down below 10 degrees, that's when all of them are moving down. And as it comes up above 10 degrees, they are starting to move up. So this is at the 10 centimeter mark. We're looking at the 10 centimeter mark here. So this temperature data could be used as an indication when wild ones are moving. And it can actually be used, it should be looked at to see if they are actually doing the same thing in other locations, using temperature as a way to put your baits in as a decision tool, or what your soil temperature is, and using that as a decision tool to decide on when you should put your baits into the field. Now, as far as neonates are concerned, it's always been said that the neonates are very delicate, and if you till your field constantly in the summer, you are going to, and leave it fallow, you're going to actually kill your neonates. But when we were looking at the neonates, we found that they were really not that delicate. We thought they were delicate, but they weren't that delicate. So this work was done by Dr. Sutilu, and what she found was that we decided to put them in, put the wild, the little tiny wild, they're really small, they're like this size, you can barely see them in the soil with the naked eye. And so she put them at the top of the tube, and she put a bait down at the bottom, and we allowed them to move down. So we had different size tubes, so 15 centimeters, 20 centimeters, 30 centimeters, and 45 centimeters. And what did we find? That these little tiny neonate wild ones, within 20 to 30, some of them could even move to 30 centimeters within 24 hours. And within 48 hours, they were at 45 centimeters or 18 inches. So you could see that, you know, tilling the soil and leaving it to dry would not kill the neonates, because they are going to sense that the soil is drying up and they're going to start moving. And this study showed us that they can move pretty fast, and they can move really long distances, which we didn't expect before. We thought that they wouldn't move. You know, 45 centimeters for a little tiny neonate wild ones. It's a very, very, very long distance for them. So tilling the soil is not such, it's not only not good for your soil, for your soil erosion and all that could happen, but it's not going to achieve what you wanted to achieve, and that is to kill the wild ones. That's not going to happen. Okay, so moving on from biology, moving on to the cultural control practices that we have discovered, one of the things that we look at is varieties. For insects and even for diseases, planting resistant varieties is something that we really, it's used in an IPM strategy. So we looked at 20 different varieties to look at the susceptibility of these varieties. And what did we find? We looked at these varieties without an insecticide. So this is truly the susceptibility of the variety itself. And what we found, we expected Norlands to be really high, because the wild ones really like red potatoes. So we found Norlands were high. Shepherdies were also quite high number of blemishes per tuber, over 20 blemishes per tuber. Your russet Burbanks are right here, and then you have your Green Mountain and Gold Rush and your FL varieties as well. So you had they were on the lower side. Your Gold Rush and Atlantic were also on the lower side. So you had some information here about your varieties that you can use, and if you have a really high population, use these varieties together with your insecticide, would give you better damage control. Plow down of green material. We know that if you plow down green material, you just give a food source to the wild ones. they will feed on their brain material. And then by the time their brain material is over and they come up to the surface to feed where you have put your insecticide, that by that time the insecticide may not be as efficacious as it was earlier in the year. So you're not getting as much control. So plowing down grain material is not such a good idea. And also, if you do plow down grain material, it leaves the field for about a year before you plant a cash crop. But we wanted to look at it in a different way. Like, what if you killed the grain material with glyphosate before we worked it in? So we did a study where we looked at a field which was treated with glyphosate. One half was treated with glyphosate, the other half was left untreated. And then we fall plowed and spring plowed that field. And then the next year we went in, after plowing in the spring, went in and planted potatoes. So the huge field was 50-acre field. What did we find? Okay. So we found that the fall plow, if you plant fall plowed or spring plowed green material, you had very high damage. But if you use glyphosate, your damage was reduced. So you're plowing down material that is dead. So you're not keeping your wire. Now there's a caveat. If you use glyphosate, if you decide to use glyphosate, you are killing your crop in the fall, but once it's dead, you are losing all your nutrients. They're getting leached out. So the reason for planting a sod crop is so that you have those nutrients in the spring. So the best option here is once you use your glyphosate, you plant a second crop. You plant a crop such as brown mustard. You plant the brown mustard crop. Brown mustard crops are good because they're very frost tolerant and they also control water loss. So if you plant your brown mustard crop, it lasts for quite a while. If you keep your brown cover there for the whole winter, crop will die out after a heavy frost, but it can still be there as a ground cover. And the next year, you work it, and then you plant your potato crop. And in that way, you're keeping your nutrients up at the surface. You don't have to put any fertilizer down when you are planting your mustard crop, because there's already nutrients there for your nitrogen there after killing your sod with the glyphosate. So there are nutrients there. You don't have to put a fertilizer and you just plant your mustard. So that's what is recommended for if you do want to go right away the second year soon after. If you want to take out a sod field and you want to go with a cash crop, then this is what is you should be doing. Now, we did a study on mustard, on brown mustard and buckwheat, so for the whole year, for the rest of the year, and it acted as a ground cover as well as a wire suppression. And then the following year, it was worked up, and the second year of the same strategy was used, and then the third year, we went to make potatoes. And what did we find? We found that both brown mustard and buckwheat used as rotation crops gave us really good control, reduction in damage. As you can see, percentage tubers loss were much lower than if you had just barley. This was a really extreme approach because it was 2 years, two crops. You had to pay for a second crop. You had to take your field out for 2 years. So it was an extreme measure, but we know it works. And if you have a really bad situation, you should be using this method. So we did a crop rotation. We did crop buckwheat and mustard crops. We looked at what if we disked them and mowed them, what would happen. So we disked the field and we mowed the field. And if you mow it, So 4 to 6 inches, it actually starts to grow again. And what did we find? We found that it didn't matter for the mustard crop if you mowed it or you clipped it or you took it to seed, you would still have pretty good wireworms damage suppression as compared to if you didn't do anything in that field. So this tells us, and this was done only for 1 year. So in, for 1 year, if you do this, clipping is just as good as actually disking it. And the same for buckwheat. We found if you disked or you mowed, it didn't matter. You still had no wild populations in your field. So it was having an effect even after 1 year. So this tells us that, you know, you don't have to go for 2 years if you have a very high, if you have a low population, you don't have to go for 2 years, and you can just mow the crop in. You don't have to really disk it in. We looked at wireworm survival on buckwheat, and we found that the neonates actually, if they feed on buckwheat, there's a survival is much lower on buckwheat than in barley, which tells us that feeding on buckwheat is actually killing the neonate wireworms. So what do we have here? So we know that you really need to evaluate your field, you need to evaluate your populations, you need to make a decision on which option you're going to use. Are you going to use the 1 year option? Are you going to use the 2 year option? You know, you could mow your crop or incorporate it or even harvest the mustard or buckwheat and still get wireworm control. Incorporation of buckwheat, if you incorporate it, you do get a biofumigation for your field, which gives you disease and nematode control as well. And then you also, the growing crop would give you some, and brown mustard would give you some level of biofumigation, but not as much. So it all depends on what you are looking for your crop to do in your field. But we now have a strategy where it's not as financially difficult to use. It's a more financially sustainable strategy for using these crops, because you don't have to pay for the second crop and use all the energy to work it into the system. Mechanical control techniques that we have developed, we have the traps, we have the pheromone trap, and we have we have the pheromone trap, and we have the nail trap, which traps females. So we're using the nail trap to look at an IPM strategy where we're putting these nails in the field to trap any females before they start laying their eggs. And we've been doing this in this field for several years now. In 2013 to 2015, this field we used to have 6.4 and 5.2 holes per tuber, but the growers started going with mustard, and we trapped that first year. We trapped 125 tick beetles per trap, but the females and males per trap. But then when we went the following years after the mustard, we started to trap fewer and fewer beetles. So we're taking the females out of the population, and the mustard controlled our wireworms. So we got very few holes in 2018. We're going to keep following this field to see if the traps are going to be able to keep the population down over the years and during the rotation years as well. Predicting wireworm damage, my colleague Todd Gabelet did a big study that he looked at in BC. And here we have you plow the field, and you plow a strip in the field, and then you put in these probe traps, so you could even put in potatoes, and then he put corn and potatoes on either side. And he looked at the correlation. What was the correlation and how many wire worms he found in that cloud section as compared to the other, in relation to the damage that he had. And as you can see here, in October, if he uses all sizes of wire worms, he has pretty high correlation for corn and for potatoes, as well as for if he uses the small wire worms, it gives him very high correlation. So this is a way to predict if you are going to have a potential problem in that particular field. Surveys, New Brunswick, Nova Scotia, and Prince Edward Island is what I'm going to be talking about for now. So we did a survey, the Maritime Survey, and we found that in the Maritimes, in Nova Scotia, we had mostly Agriotis potato was our main species, with Lineatus following, and Obscurus, there were very few. But in New Brunswick, it was Hypnoides aureliatus, which seemed to be our major species. There was some Agriotis potato in some locations, but mainly at Hypnoides aureliatus. Now, we did this study in Prince Edward Island that we've been doing for years now, since 2009. And we go back every 2, 3, or 4 years, we go back to exactly the same fields and we put these traps out. And then we count the number of beetles that we found. And the same number of traps go in every year. And here I'm just showing you what we found. I'm showing you the true numbers just to show you the enormity of the problem that we were dealing with on Prince Edward Island. And here we have in 2009, populations are pretty low, but then they started just increasing and even moving other regions. We always had them in Queens County, but they started moving to Prince and Kings County. And this is where growers started using the brown mustard and buckwheat strategy. Somewhere in 2013-14 is when they just started. A few growers were using it, but then more and more growers started using it. And in 2019, we saw a real decrease in populations. Now, we are going to keep following this to see, to determine, like, if it's going to go up again or if it's going to just continue to go down. So we are going to keep following this, these same sites. So research on biological control. We have a fungus that my colleague, once again, in Todd Cadwallock in BC has been looking at this fungus. What's interesting is that it works against several different species. Here's the name of all the different species that it works against. So these are promising results. We don't have the fungus, it's not available yet, but there is potential for it to be a really good biological control agent for a lot of different species. So what do we know until now? So we do have information about when the beetles emerge and when to place your traps in the field. We do know when the eggs are laid and where they are laid. We have the duration of the bait trapping, so you know, don't go for 7 days, go for 5 days. Best time to bait is in the spring and the fall is September into October and then in April. Or when the temperature gets to about 10 degrees, soil temperatures around 10 degrees. Tilling the soil is not going to kill your wild or your neonate wire worms, so you know it's not a good option. Susceptibility, you know what potato varieties are susceptible to wire worm damage. We have a plow down strategy, how you could plow down the green manure or your sod crop. Best approaches to wire worm suppressive crops. So what are you going to use there? We have a way to predict damage. Best species that are present and not available right now, but it is going to be available in the future, and Todd's working very hard to make that available for the future. So our future goal is actually to develop, now that we have a few strategies in place, we want to develop an IPM manual. In the near future, we want to put that together so that growers would actually have a manual that they can refer to. We'd like to thank the CHC for the funding and all our collaborators as well. We've been in the cluster since the very beginning, since 2011, since Science Cluster 1, and now we are in 3, and this has really helped us to move forward faster than what we would normally have moved at. We do have other sources of funding as well, but this cluster has really helped us in moving this whole bioworm management strategies forward, and actually coming up with proper practical strategies that growers can use. We'd really like to thank growers not only from these 3 provinces but also from British Columbia and Alberta, as well as from Ontario, because they have also worked with us on these bioworm control strategies. That's it. And if anybody has any questions, you're welcome to call me at any time or just email me. Thank you.
Thanks so much, Christine. Wonderful time. Okay, so remember, if you have any questions, please type those into the chat box at any time during the webinar, and we'll address them during the question and answer session after presentations. Our next presenter is Wim Van Herk, who is a research scientist with AAFC Agassiz. Wim began working at AAFC in 2003 when he started a PhD project on behavioral response of 2 wireworm pest species, Agrotis obscurus and Limonois canis, 2 insecticides, work which combined elements of toxicology, pest management, and behavioral ecology. This research first demonstrated the unique effects of different insecticide classes on wireworms, including their ability to recover from prolonged morbidity induced by dermal contact or ingestion of neonicotinoids, the repellency to pyrethroids, and the latent irreversible morbidity caused by contacting or ingesting final urealysis. These findings remain pivotal for understanding the success and failure of various wireworm management approaches in the field and form the basis of their subsequent wireworm management program. Wim still works at AAFC on vegetable and field crop pests with a focus on the biology and management of wireworms and click beetles. To date, he has published more than 40 peer-reviewed papers and 2 book chapters, identify wireworms of economic importance from across Canada. This project is currently in its 16th year. His other research interests and publications deal with management of cabbage root maggot and rutabaga, thrips and potatoes, and western corn rootworm. Take it away, please, Wim.
Thank you very much, Ashley. Can everybody hear me? Am I coming through clear?
You're good. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you. Thank you very much for that. And thank you very much, Christine, for the beautiful first part of the presentation. Really, really enjoyed that. I want to be talking about managing wireworms in potato, new tools and other developments. My co-authors listed here are Bob Vernon, who many of you know, Christina Rona, and my technician, Tarisha Mitchell. My talk will focus on the following points. The pest species in BC to Quebec, their distribution, somewhat on their biology. I want to talk about monitoring tools and pheromone development, methods for targeting the adult stage, the beetle stage, new chemistries and risk assessment. And a note at the bottom, the talk might sort of weave in between these topics, and it'll be referring to other people's work at times, and I'll mention them, and different wireworm projects that we're doing. So as Christine already mentioned, wireworms affect very many different crops. You grow it, they'll eat it. There's about 400 species of wireworms in Canada. Only 10 to 20 of those are actually pests. And pest in problems from wireworms are increasing across Canada. Christine already mentioned that in eastern Canada, we have these three Agriodes species, which were introduced from Europe in the 1800s. Two of those are pests in British Columbia. And when we started the survey in 2003, 2004, we really didn't have a good idea what the pest complex was, the wireworm pest complex in these other areas. That started the survey in 2004, which we are basically just completed. And this could not have been done without the help of very many people and different agencies. And we want to thank you all very, very much for your contributions to this initiative. Especially want to call out Syngenta, who had a baitballing drive, as we call it, for the prairies, first using their own baitball kit, which is pictured there, and later our pitfall trap to assess where what pest species were across the prairies. An example of this survey for the prairies, here you see data from 600 different locations. About a quarter of those had more than one pest species located per field, pest species being different in their biologies and so. Just calling out one of these species, Hypnoides bicolor, which is similar to Hypnoides abbreviatus, which Christine already mentioned, distributed throughout. So we have a number of these survey maps available. The predominant pest species were these five, if you include Hadromorphis. And for more information on this, there will be a field guide that is about to be published, authored by Dr. Hilly Catton, who was already mentioned, from the Lethbridge Research Center, and an upcoming distribution paper as well. The majority of these pest species were Hypnoides bicolor, Ancelatosomus destructor, that I've put pointed arrows to. Oops. And this is what they look like. They're quite different in size, both as beetles and as larvae. Bicolor will live for 2 to 3 years, destructor for up to 9 years before it pupates. But when they're babies, they're almost indistinguishable when they're just hatched. Where we have fields in, say, southern Alberta or southern Saskatchewan that are complete crop wrecks. For example, the bottom right field, the only thing that came up was some weeds. The suspects were these two species that I got pictured here, which were the two predominant species. But if you actually stick in a bait ball trap, like you see here in the bottom left, and you then retrieve that after about 2 weeks, and you see it's just teeming with wireworms there. It's actually Limonius californicus that was the main pest species in these complete crop wrecks. And what I've pictured here in the top left is that within 1 year, within one sample, you'll see that there are different cohorts of species. You'll have some larvae that are 1 year old or neonates, some that are 2 or 3 or 4 years old. And at 4 years, that's sort of when this species will pupate, just like Agriodes putator does after 4 years, which was mentioned before. We conducted surveys with the help of University of Guelph, Dr. Jocelyn Smith, and Art Chasma in Ontario. And you see, what I want you to take away from here is that these are the five predominant pest species from about 1,300 locations where we collected wireworms from. And the five species are in five different genera. They're all five very different from each other in terms of life history, susceptibility to insecticides and biocontrol agents and things like that. That really complicates management of your pests. Same thing for Quebec. This is a survey done 2011 to 2015 by Dr. Julian Saguet from Sorum. He sampled about 600 sites using 14,000 traps, collected about 6,000 wireworms, And again, the same thing as Ontario, you've got, and same thing as the prairies, you have a complex of different pests. Sometimes they co-occur in one field. They belong to different genera, as you see here. And he's published this work, so you can refer to that if you're interested. In his case, Hypnoides abbreviatus was the predominant pest species. That was different than Ontario, where it was Limonius agonis. So different locations in Canada have different pest species. Actually, Julian also produces very nice wireworm guide, identification guide for Quebec, but it's also very useful for Ontario and Eastern Canada. So what do we really know about species, right? We know the life history as it proceeds in general, right? They emerge in spring, lay their eggs, which hatch into these neonate wireworms, first year wireworms, and then they live for a number of years causing damage, pupate when they're big enough, overwinter as adults, and then emerge. And Christine already went over that. But if you look at some of these species, like these Aeolus species that I got in the top left, those are mostly predaceous. They can cause crop damage, but they're mostly predaceous and actually will feed on the eggs of other wireworms. And another thing is some species fly and some don't. And that, of course, really affects their ability to invade new areas and to disperse. We don't know that much about their natural enemies, which I got on the right side of the slide. And of course, Christine already mentioned about different biocontrol agents like metarhizium that Todd Cabalog from Ag Canada and Agassiz are working on. And that might affect different species differently. Lots to learn. So what do we know about these different pest species? Obviously, they're different in size. They differ in their life history and biology. Some of them are female only. They're parthenogenetic. Their time of emergence will differ between species. When the larvae are active and feed will differ. They differ in their susceptibility to insecticides and their ability to damage crops. Small wireworms cause less damage than big ones, for example. Most of what we know about their biology is based on stuff we did on Agriotis obscurus, where we monitored them in our pitfall traps over time and correlated that with temperature and when eggs mature within the bodies and when the peak emergence is, and those two tend to correlate. So that's based on hundreds of wireworms that we had to dissect and count the eggs. And you can see that around the time of peak emergence is when all their fat, the red bars, gets converted to eggs, which is the blue bars. And these pest groupings per region are not necessarily the same currently as they used to be in the 40s and 50s when initial surveys were in female beetles. And I want to talk a little bit about the Vernon pitfall trap that we developed some years ago to replace that box trap you see in the middle top. This bottom left picture shows capture in PEI in some traps. This is Agriotis sputator. And its effectiveness is shown here that, you know, you can collect so many that you basically counting is too difficult and you have to actually measure them and use beetle volume and compute your numbers from there. And we use that for some survey work we did as well as some native Agriotis species for Ontario, Quebec, and BC. This is very much a team effort. This is a slide from a presentation that Emily did last month. And just to highlight, we have participants from Simon Fraser, Canada, Mayland Consulting in Calgary, Montana State, et cetera, right? Called Trap Catch here in the bottom center. It has a very, very short collecting season. So here we collect about 20,000 beetles over 1 week in 24 traps. It was pretty astounding. This year, we tried to do that testing on a number of different Limonia species in the Pacific Northwest, as well as one study we did in with University of Guelph in for Limonius agonis in Ontario. These are some field shots from this year. You see where the traps are located and what the traps look like when we put them into the ground and when we take them out again. Of course, that's best case scenario, but still just some grab of data from Kelowna and Idaho and Oregon, and so showing the different effectiveness of these pheromones, very, very highly attractive compounds. So that's very promising. Another species we did this with is Solatosomus destructor, that large wireworm I showed you before from the prairies. Again, showing that there's two compounds they respond to. Females might respond more to the one and males more to the other. So there's some exciting work we're trying to do. How can you use them? You can use them for monitoring to try to assess the risk of wireworms for your next year's crop. You can use them for mating disruption, for example, pheromone-treated granules, which I'll show you, or for mass trapping to basically try to capture all the males before they can mate. And you can use it in an attract and kill strategy. For example, you can attract them using pheromones. You can attract them to Metarhizium, which then infects and kills them. That's work that Todd Kabalek is working on. If you want to kill the adults, it's a pay it forward strategy. You can try to kill the beetles in order to prevent the next generation of wireworms. You still have wireworms in the field that need to mature and emerge, so you don't have an immediate control. Using pheromones, you might want to target the hot spots in the field where you have to want to put your traps for mass trapping approaches. You can also spray the entire field, perhaps, with field sprays. I'll talk about that too. So mass trapping, this is work that's pioneered by Dr. Vernon, using these pheromone curtains. This is a slide from one of his presentations from work done in PEI. And you see the grassy headland, you see the pheromone traps are along it. The pheromones capture or the pheromone traps capture these beetles, the male beetles, that prevents the females from being mated and then going into the field and laying their eggs and causing grief. This is what pheromone granules look like. This is a study done at Agassiz Station, and there's my technician Teresha broadcasting these pheromone granules in order to disorient the males so they cannot find the females and mate with them. Sprays for females, sprays for beetles. A big note on top, there is nothing registered for beetles, so don't go rogue, please. Some work we did in PEI and in BC with Agriotis sputater and Agriotis obscurus doing these oversprays. There's actually beetles inside this trap with the little grass plug you see there, testing different insecticides and looking at their survival. There's a little field spray that we're doing, that's me on the tractor, and in the oval you see there's actually a tray, plastic tray, with little cups of beetles that we were spraying over as well to see both click beetles and beneficial insects like ground beetles to see what the response was of, for example, if you spray with Matador or Lambda sahalothran at different rates. And one thing we noticed, that different species respond differently. After the spray, one spray, it killed 45% of your obscurus, but 85% of Lineatus. And these two species occur in the same field, and they're very similar to each other. So different species respond differently. This is work we did in PEI, also with Matador. This is an entire field spray. Again, in the oval, you see, this tray with beetles. Nothing is registered right now, but this is what happens. This is a different field in PEI. You see the population. This is how many beetles were caught. Male beetles were caught per day, up to 1,400 male beetles per trap per day. You see the beetles coming in here. This is before the spray. This is after the spray. So it really reduced the numbers. And you see there's this edge effect from where they are starting to reinvade the field from the edge. I believe this is the last slide. So Ashley, if you can move me over to the next group of slides. Talking now about new chemistries, a lot of our work at the Research Center in Agassiz is done on wheat, treated wheat. After we lost lindane in 2004, there's been a real critical need to find new control products, and that's led to a lot of screening. Looks like Spud Smart has left the room. That can't be good. Can you still hear me, Ashley? Good. So we did a lot of screening. Good, thank you. We did a lot of screening studies in the lab and in the field, testing different classes of insecticides, like neonicotinoids and pyrethroids, diamides, fipronil, spinosins, to find something that's equivalent to lindane or better. And some of this work's been published. And what that's where we found, as Ashley mentioned in the introduction, that most chemicals cause reversible intoxication, knocks them down, they recover, or it repels them, like the pyrethroids do, from the seed, doesn't kill them. Or fipronil, which works really well, we couldn't get registered, so we were looking for the next best, or something equal to fipronil. This is an overview of how our studies are done. As Christine mentioned, we try to top kill and not plow down the sod. And then everything is done extremely meticulously. Everything is done by hand, counting, seeding, harvesting. And then we put in our bait traps in fall or the next year to see what wirum survival is like. And we extract our bait traps in the funnel room, as we have the Tolgren funnel room. That lets us answer if an insecticide gives crop protection as well as wirum mortality. Because in lindane, those two things went together. In a lot of the new chemicals, they do not. You might have crop protection, you might not get wirum mortality, and that's a problem. Here's a study done in Alberta showing what fipronil will do. Even at 1 gram against Limonius californicus, again, every plot was completely decimated except the ones that are left standing, which is fipronil. Then we had the big news that broflanolide was coming, and it's a new mode of action. This was news that BASF announced in November 2018. It binds to the same place in the insect nervous system as lindane and fipronil, but at a different site, so there won't be cross resistance. And it's registered, so that's really big news. And we've been working on testing this chemical for 7 years, which we just wrote up and published if you want to read more on it. But we first started looking at it in 2012. This is the control plots on the left, and if you put on broflanolide, that's the stand you see on the right. We got excited, but not too excited, because we didn't know if it killed wireworms until the next year, and then we noticed that we had like 85-86% kill in two different studies. So that was good. And that remained consistent over the years we did it. This is at 2.5 and 5 gram rates. And you see it provides stand protection equal to thimethoxam and control equal to fipronil or at least lindane. We also did some work with broflanolide on Agriota sputater in PEI. And same thing, you have very good stand protection, even at the 2.5 and 5 gram rates, and that's the green bars, and 93-95% killed in this particular year, 2016. So the take home there is that broflanolide is effective at a 5 gram active rate per 100 kilogram wheat seed on Agriota obscurus and Agriota sputater. It provides stand protection in wheat as well as wirum mortality, reducing wirum numbers by 70-90%. So potential uses for this, you can use it as a seed, cereal seed treatment. You can use it in crop rotation as a cleanup crop where you plant a treated cereal crop 1 year and say potatoes the following year. That would work. You can reduce your wirum populations that way because wirums, they live for 3 or 4 or 5 years in the soil. And you kill all the different stages that I'm showing here all in that first year. So you'll have a much reduced risk to your crops in the subsequent 2 or 3 years. before the population is built up again. You can use treated cereal seed as an attract and kill strategy right in with your, by sprinkling the seed in with your potatoes. These potatoes pieces here just have fungicide on them, nothing else. And then the wheat comes up, you can spray it out if you want to. We found it did not reduce yield if you keep it in, and it didn't really complicate matters if you for harvesting if you leave it in. Of course, we harvest by hand, so that's a little different. And when you do this with fipronil, you can actually have equal control to thimet or better. This is thimet applied at 3.2 kilograms active per hectare. And we could reduce the amount of insecticide to 1.7 grams fipronil per hectare with a similar tuber blemish reduction. And that's the strategy we are trying to do with broflanolide as well, potentially. You can use broflanolide as a direct application, as an in-furrow spray. This is our potato trials, as we do them in Agassiz. You see, again, everything's done by hand. And all the potatoes get washed and graded by hand for scars and blemishes, as Christine mentioned before. And this is the sort of data we were finding at the, this is a C-piece treatment then, and over the, right underneath where it says 97%, you see that's BASF or broflanolide at in-furrow spray of 0.225 grams active per 100 meters. Your damage suppression in this case, 2018, was 97% relative to the control, and your wirum reduction was 99% relative to the control. And Christine has also been doing the same studies in PEI at the same time, which is really, really cool. And the numbers might, this is her data in the bottom, and you know, the numbers might be a little different than the graph above it, but notice the dotted bar. You're trying to get something that's equal to thymet 20, and you're obviously doing better where you see the starred bars. So very, very promising results in multiple species in potato. Same thing. This is 2019 data from Agassiz. You see 94 to 97% blemish reduction and 98% reduction in wirum numbers. So in terms of relative application rates per hectare, if this is what you put on for thymet capture and poncho in terms of grams active, this is what you'd be putting on. This is the fourth line. If you put it on as an in-furrow spray at 0.25 grams, for example, only 25 grams active. And if you put it on wheat seed at 5 grams active and sprinkle it in, you can reduce that further. Moving on to determining if your field is at risk for wirum damage. Bob and I have been working on this guide for assessing a risk and made a little brochure. I'll just show a few slides of it. Basically, it combines elements of what you know about your field history to establish a baseline risk score in green, and then to confirm that with sampling for larvae and beetles to validate that score. So it's a two-component part. In terms of your baseline risk, your field history, it determines on how many years your field has been in pasture. It depends on how many years you've grown a crop that's favorable for beetles to lay their eggs in, that they would prefer to lay their eggs in. That score is up to 10. And it also depends on what happens in the neighborhood. If there's a lot of wirum damage in your neighborhood, you want to factor that into your equation. And the maximum score here is 25. And as you see, if your risk score is 0 to 1, you're at no risk. If it's over 10, it's at extreme risk, and you don't want to plant potatoes in that field. So that's how you establish establish a baseline risk. And in order to come up with the numbers, you look at things like this. Okay, so as you see, in the first year, if there is, that's the most recent growing season. If you have your field was in pasture, you'd give it 2 points. If 2 years ago your field is in pasture, you give yourself 3 points. If 3 years ago your field was in pasture, you give yourself 3 points, and or your field 3 points, I should say. And that adds up. If you know, if you have all 4 years you were in pasture, that'd be 10 points out of 10. That's how you start to establish your baseline risk. About validating the risk factor, you can use wireworm trapping, you can use beetle trapping. I'm showing beetle trapping here. You give your field a number of points based on how many beetles you are collecting in your trap over a season. If you collect more than 500 beetles in a trap over a season, and we've had lots of fields in PEI where we collected over 500 per day, well, that's 3 points right there. So where do you put your traps? You would put your traps in your headlands, but you have to determine where and how many. And so we did some work on that as well. This is PEI again, where we had a number of fields where we put in our traps, either in the center of the field or, as you see, the light green, that's around the edge of the field, or in dark green, where you can put them directly in the field headlands. And this is the numbers that you get. I'm going to focus on the field headlands, the dark green, and I just put in some numbers, the numbers beside it. This is over a season, and it shows you that there are certain locations where the numbers are obviously very high. So those are the hotspots you want to go after and eliminate. Or those are also the hotspots where you want to put in your traps to determine to determine your risk to the field. So knowing where in the field the wireworm numbers are highest or beetle numbers are highest is extremely important, and has been a subject of some surveys we did. I'm showing you one field here. We monitored quite a number of fields, as I'll show in a moment. One thing you want to know is, just because numbers are high in one part of your field, is that consistent from 1 year to the next? Are populations stable over time? And how well do these numbers that you have this year correlate with the risk you have next year for wireworm damage? Also, throughout the whole field, are your overall numbers sort of similar from 1 year to another? And that will probably really depend on your cropping history. So to determine if, to try to answer some of these questions and to try to determine if a hotspot or area of high numbers of beetles is the same 1 year after another, we did the same sort of surveys I showed before in a whole number of different fields in PEI and to a smaller extent back home here in Agassiz. And then had the same locations for 4 years in a row. So these fields have different crop histories and things like that, different contours and different perimeter vegetation and all that. So we can sort of try to tease all that out, which is not easy. So that takes me to, I guess, my second last slide, which is future directions from here to really assess risk and know where to go in the field and what areas to target. It's going to require a fair amount of data analysis and interpreting the data. So that's one thing that we hope to work on in the next couple of years, as well as continue to develop these new management tools, both chemical and non-chemical. I talked about insecticides and pheromone granules for disruption and mass trapping. We also do a number of other things like cultivation and stuff and fallowing and whatever. There's a number of other non-chemical tools we're exploring as well in Agassiz. We want to continue working on these new monitoring tools, pheromone-based or not, and this risk rating system to see if we can extend that to other species, other parts of Canada, where we have different species we need to take into account. And we obviously have a need to do more biology and life history studies so we have the same sort of data for other pest species as Christine showed for Agriotis sputata and that I was showing for Agriotis obscurus and lineatus in BC. We need to have that same level of detail for the prairie species. So there's quite a bit of work still ahead of us. With that, I want to give a very special thank you to SpotSmart for asking us and hosting us and you for listening, bearing with us. Also to my collaborators, especially Simon Fraser University and many, many other stakeholders that help with in many ways with all this work. Tricia Mitchell has been my indispensable sidekick, my technician. And then there's an amazing group of students that we rely on from year to year. Very big thank you to my funders for making any of this available, any of this possible, rather. You can contact me. This is my email address, whenever. There's also, for further reading, Bob and I have a chapter in this book, Insect Pests of Potato. They'll be coming up in a second edition very soon. Has a lot of life history and management technique information. With that, I've come to the end of my presentation, so I'll leave it at this and turn it back to you, Ashley.
Thanks so much, Wim. Okay, so now we're going to do a short question and answer session. If you have a question for either of our presenters that you haven't in yet, please type it into the chat box now. And I'll start with our first one. It comes from Cody Winnott. And the question is, how deep do they burrow for the winter? And Christine, how about you start off the answer there?
Okay, so we found that they can go up to, they can go pretty deep. They go up to
70 centimeters. Christine, you're coming out a bit there. Could you speak up a bit?
Can you hear me now?
Yes, that's better. Thank you.
Okay. So our study showed that they can go fairly deep. Like they went to about, in our study, we had them go down to 50 centimeters, which was really deep. But and they can go down to 80 centimeters. They're right at the bottom of the tube. They are very resistant to frost. We have actually frozen them. We took them back and we froze them to about -7, and they were still alive at -7, so they're very resistant to frost.
Thank you. And our next question is from Rennie Spearings, and he asks, is the 2-centimeter strip equal for all sorts of click beetle? And I know this was from when Christine was speaking, so Christine, please answer.
Could you repeat that again, Ashley? I couldn't get that.
Is the 2-centimeter strip equal for all sorts of click beetle?
I don't know. Like our for egg laying, right? The 2 centimeters egg laying. I'm not sure if the other species would do the same or not. We really have to study the other species. I'm not sure if they would also lay at 2 centimeters. I know our species does.
Wim, do you have anything to add to that?
It depends. From what I've read, it depends quite a bit on soil texture too, and species can lay their eggs a fair amount deeper than that. Like the prairie species will go up to 10 centimeters or deeper. If they have dry soil and there's cracks, they find they'll go into the crack and they'll lay it quite deeply, because the critical thing for them is to find sufficient soil moisture in the soil for these eggs to hatch, to dry, and at least for the Western species, as soil is too dry, the eggs won't hatch. And it's one of the most vulnerable stages of the wireworm is the egg. So they'll go deeper if there's a crack and if the soil is dry.
Thank you. Our next question is from Thea Van Beers. Do you expect other species to move just as far? And why don't we start with you there, Wim?
Thanks. I think I would say something similar as my last answer. It's really going to depend on species. For example, your agriotes tend to have a pretty hard cuticle. They're called the hard-bodied virus, and the locust is another one that's like that. Your hypnoides and your limonius and your solatosomus are all called soft-bodied virus. They're a much softer body, so they might not be able to move as easily through the soil. It depends on soil texture, soil compaction. I'm fascinated by the results that Christine was showing, and I think that needs to be repeated for the prairie species as well. Again, taking into account different soil types and compaction and things like that, because I guess my short answer is I don't know, but that's sort of what it comes to.
Christine, do you have anything you'd like to add to that?
I agree with Wim. We don't know what the other species, how they move through the soil. It would depend, like Wim said, on compaction and the type of soil that it is, and also the cuticles of the other species. It would vary and has to be studied.
Thank you, Christine. If you can please remember to mute yourself when you're not speaking, that'd be great for background noise. Our next question comes from Remy again, and it is there a correlation between CO2 content of potato CP and wireworm damage? Christine, would you like to answer that first?
Can you repeat that again, Ashley? What content?
Can you please mute yourself when you're not speaking? We're getting some feedback from your...
Yes. So what was your question again?
Is there a relation between CO2 content of potato CV and wireworm damage?
Carbon dioxide there. So there has been a correlation. They have seen that they do get attracted to CO2. But in relation to damage, they come into the tubers late in the fall. It's something, CO2 is something that we use to attract them to our baits. That's what we're using them for. But correlation with damage, I haven't done any studies to actually see that, to look at that correlation. Now, I don't know if Wim has done any studies, so Wim, can you speak more about this if you have done anything?
Yeah, we haven't done any of that ourselves. I think wireworms just come up in fall in order to feed. And yes. If there's potatoes there, they'll feed on potatoes. And some varieties have higher levels of glycoalkaloids in their outer tissues. And I think, I believe there's some papers actually that people have published on this, correlating that at least. So your potato variety will differ in glycoalkaloid content, and people have correlated that to the level of wireworm damage. So that's one possible way explaining this.
Thank you. And Christine, can you please remember to mute yourself when you're not speaking? Our next question is from Aza Roland. And it is ace potato, the most common in Canada. Wim, why don't you start with the answer?
Agriotis potata is found in. It's not found right throughout Canada. It's found in Nova Scotia, PEI. We found them in New Brunswick. They're not like the main species right across Canada.
Thank you. Our next question is from Remy, and he says, what type of light did you use in the light traps?
The light trap has just a common garden solar light. The intensity of the light has to be there, so you have to have a stronger light. But it's a normal garden solar light that we are using.
Thank you. Our next question is also from Rami, and it is the placing of the pheromone trap of influence on the amount of click beetles we catch?
When do you want to speak on that?
Yeah, I'm just going to ask you to repeat it. I just caught about half the question.
So the question is the placing of the pheromone traps of influence on the amount of click beetles you can't catch?
Very much so. As you saw, that one slide, towards the end where I showed a field and there were pheromone traps inside the field and then along the outer edge and then in the headlands on the outside of the field. It can make a huge difference where you place your traps, whether it's inside the field or in the headlands. You can use the headlands placement really well, by the way, to monitor. And it has the advantage of being out of the way of equipment and such and farming operations. But where you place it in, you're likely going to catch a lot more than if it's a narrow area, or if there's no farmland on the other side, or if it is very low-lying and likely going to be flooded. So, and that's one of the things you're trying to figure out is where should you go into the field, like where in the field should you go in order to put your trap to have a reasonable catch.
Thank you. Have you looked at more suppressive crops? Christine, how about you start with the answer?
Can you please repeat that?
The question is, have you looked at more suppressive crops?
We are in the process of looking at more suppressive crops. We're looking at sorghum, Sudan grass, and flax. We just started the trial a couple of years ago, so we will get the information in another couple of years. We will have the information on those two crops as well.
Thank you. Our next question is from Florian Krieger, and it's how high is the deviation of your trap results? Are they fairly consistent and comparable over the years? Christine, I think this was from during your presentation, so please answer.
So this is a variation in the trap results for the light traps. Is that what they're talking about?
I think so. It was from towards the end of your presentation.
Okay, so it's variation in the traps. There is a variation in the traps. So we do find in some cases we do find fewer traps. That's why we take when we look at the field, we always look at the number per trap. We don't look at what we found, because the population in the field also is variable from place to place. So as a result, we have to take an average average per trap, and that's how we collect our data, or that's how we present our data.
Thank you. Our next question is there a cheap PCR technique available to distinguish the wireworms? Wim, why don't you answer?
Yeah, this is something that various people have worked on, and it's very region-specific. Most of the wireworm species that we've collected, we have done barcoding on them. For Europe, for example, there's about 11 or so different best species. They're all Agriotes, and there's a PCR technique that they've developed to distinguish between them. We are not quite at the stage where we have that in Canada. It's something I'm working on. And hopefully in a couple of years, we'll have something like that. I should say I'd like to work on. And hopefully a couple of years down the road, we will have that. But the first step was just to figure out what are the different pest species in different areas. And if you have a, if you know that, say, Agrodes sputata and obscurus do not occur in the prairies, you might not need to have a PCR kit available to the prairies that includes that particular species. And that would really make it a little bit easier rather than having to try to separate between all different pest species in every part of Canada. Let's just go make it region specific.
Thank you. Our next question is from Remy again. And it is, are neonic fipronil a future option as an insecticide? Wim, why don't you answer?
I don't think we have much hope for getting fipronil here. So I would say that's probably a no. Neonics seem to be subject to re-evaluations quite frequently. And I think the writing is on the wall for them too. So hopefully we can hold on to what we have. But in terms of future options, I think we're all sort of looking at things, newer chemistries that are coming.
Thank you. We have another question from Remy, and it's, do you have experience with CO2 traps? Wim, I think that was from during your presentation.
My colleague, Todd Kabaluk, here in Agassiz, has been working a fair bit on CO2 evolution or production, I guess, by different substances and their potential for using them in traps. I'm not very familiar with that. I know there's work being done on it, or that has been done on it.
And we have one last question from Vikram Bish, and he's asking, is anyone working on carrots? Christine, why don't you answer?
We are working. We do some work on carrots, but not that much. We work. We do some work with carrots. So there is some work that is being done in PEI, at least with carrots.
Thank you. And we have one last question, once again from Vikram, and it's, what is the time for setting traps? Soil temperature based on some other variable? Christine or Wim?
I can speak to that. For setting the traps, we found that the adults are usually, at least here, they're usually, or they're out. You don't really see them because they hide in under the soil when it's cool. But when the temperature reaches close to like 12 degrees, 12, 13 degrees, and above 10, that's when you actually start to see them moving. So you can place your traps out quite early, and you might, depending on the temperature, if it's a warm sunny day, you will get some beetles, but if it's a warm sunny day, you get more, but if it's cooler, you're not going to get any. So we put our traps out somewhere in April, and even though it's really cold, like the end of April, we don't really see numbers going up until mid-May is when we start to see the numbers. So I think it's that 10-day over temperature is, and at that time, we'll really see movement happening.
Thank you. Well, that's all we have time for today. I'd like to thank our speakers, Christine and Wim, for joining us today. I would once again like to thank our partner, the Canadian Potato Council, for making this webinar possible. And a big thank you goes out to everyone for participating. I hope you have found this information valuable. Again, a recording of this webinar will be made available on spudsmart.com. Thanks again, and we hope you have a wonderful day.